Welcome to the Gen Z Stoic Podcast,
where every week we strive to lead younger generations on a path to virtue through the insight of Stoic teachings and personal stories from our lives as Gen Z Stoics.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Gen Z Stoic Podcast. I am your co-host, Mateo.
And I'm your co-host, Ren. And this week we are very excited to welcome Giovanni Densman to the podcast. Giovanni is a meditation teacher, best-selling author, and self-discipline coach. He's the creator of Live and Dare, the fifth most popular meditation blog on the planet, and author of the best-selling book, Practical Meditation. Giovanni has over 10,000 hours of personal meditation practice and is a highly sought-after consultant to award-winning meditation apps. His meditation programs have been doing very important work, helping over 20,000 people start a daily meditation practice, improve their psychological well-being, and master their minds. Giovanni recently released his new book, Wise Confidence, which we will talk about today. Giovanni, thank you for coming to the Gen Z Stoic and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So let's get right into it. You have a very impressive resume when it comes to meditation, but where did your meditation journey really begin and what resources did you find most helpful starting out?
When I started meditating, you know, I started my interest in meditation when I was 14, 15 years old. At that time, I wanted to know more about philosophy, religion, metaphysics, and I was reading everything that I could get my hands on. At that time, meditation was not very popular, and it wasn't cool to meditate. When I would tell my friends that I meditate, they're like, what's that? So that was the question. Very different times today. So all of the books that I was reading, they were pointing out to the need to train our mind, and especially through meditation practice. So I started trying some different ways of practicing meditation, and I felt that it takes me to a very special state, a state that I wouldn't experience in my day-to-day life. So little by little, I got more interested. I went more in-depth into the practice. I went into Buddhism. I almost became a Zen Buddhist monk when I was 19 years old. And so I tried different traditions, different styles of practice, and that's how my journey began.
It's interesting you bring that up, because there are a lot of parallels between Buddhism and Stoicism specifically, right? We've sort of talked about that. They were created, you know, two different, very, very different demographic areas, different parts of the world at different times, and yet they're still very, very similar.
Many of these ancient philosophies and traditions, you know, Buddhism, yoga, Stoicism, all of them emphasize the importance of self-discipline or self-mastery, that we should be in control of our thoughts and emotions, rather than being thrown away here and there by our thoughts and emotion.
And so with, you know, a lot of this meditation practice, can you explain some of the most popular techniques for meditation that are known to most people? And then what are your specific favorites that maybe aren't talked about as much, or that you use that help you the best?
Okay. So there are hundreds of different styles of meditation, just like there are hundreds of different ways to exercise the body. And meditation is like exercises for the body, meditation is for the mind. Now, if I would classify all of those styles of meditation into buckets, I'd say that we have four or five different buckets of meditation. The first one, which is the most known one, is concentration meditation. And in this style of practice, you are training your mind to stay focused on the same object moment after moment. That object could be the breath, which is the most popular one. It could be a mantra. It could be a part of the body, like the third eye, for example. It could be an image that you're visualizing. It could be a sentence. It could be anything. The point is your attention is narrow but deep, right? You're focused on a single thing. Then the second bucket is the observation meditation practices. And this one is the opposite. Instead of attention being narrow and deep, attention is shallow but wide. You are observing whatever you are noticing in the screen of your consciousness in the present moment. It could be, you know, your legs are a little bit in pain, or there's some noise and the thought is coming up, and then there's a funny smell in the room, or whatever it is coming to your awareness. You are noticing that without holding on to it, without pushing it, just letting everything come and go. Then styles of meditation that fit in here, you know, the mindfulness meditation, Vipassana, inner silence, yogic meditation, and some other ones. Then we have the relaxation styles of meditation. And the purpose of this is not to train your attention to either focus or observe, but to really deeply relax the body, the mind, and the nervous system. And this is typically a body scan type of exercise, the most well-known one being yoga nidra. And then the fourth one is what will sound the most kind of esoteric. I call it the pure being practices or the pure awareness practices. In this one, it's almost like you're taking a step outside of your mind. You are not trying to focus the mind. You're not observing the mind. You are letting everything be as it is. And it's almost like your attention turns 180 degrees towards yourself, the source of your being. And you're left in a state of pure I am-ness. It's hard to describe, but in that state, you know, there's just peace. There's stillness. There's no noise. And then we can talk about a fifth bucket of practice, which is the visualization or imagination practices, where you are trying to create a behavior change or a state, an emotion, by using visualization, by using imagery. You're trying to create a change within yourself. So these are like the five main buckets of meditation practice, and the hundreds of different techniques, they will fit into one or more of these.
So in these definitions, you mix the term meditation and mindfulness, and this isn't something we really fully covered, but we probably should. What is the difference between mindfulness and meditation?
So it depends on how you understand the term mindfulness, and the term mindfulness is used in different ways by different people, teachers, groups, etc. If we're talking about mindfulness as a trait, as the quality of being aware, of being attentive, then that is a quality of our minds, that it can be trained in meditation, in many different styles of meditation, whether it's mindfulness meditation or another style. It will all train your awareness. But you can also train this as you are going day to day in your life. You're doing the dishes, talking, taking shower, whatever. If you're fully aware in the moment, fully present, not living that automatic mode, but being present and aware of what's going on, you are cultivating that skill of mindfulness. So that is mindfulness as a skill or a trait. And if you practice this enough, then you get into the state of mindfulness. Now, another thing is the mindfulness as a technique, as a meditation technique. Then again, different groups will mention it differently. But in that case, mindfulness, then it's one of the many styles of meditation. And people usually mean one of two things when they are talking about mindfulness as a specific technique. Either it's that observation of, you know, being mindful of whatever is happening in the moment without grasping, without pushing away anything, or it's focusing on the breath. So you see, the same word is used by different people for different purposes. So it's natural that there's some confusion.
Yeah. I've heard mindfulness used in a variety of ways. I personally like the definition of that awareness. I think it's certainly, when you view it that way, I think meditation becomes much more of a tool. And that's certainly encouraged me in my personal life to use more meditation practices. So you've kind of been seen it all, maybe not seen it all, but you've been around when it comes to meditation. So what are some of the most important benefits to meditation that you can describe, and things that people maybe don't think about?
So, you know, there are all of the proven benefits of meditation as per the research. And if you Google the 76 benefits of meditation, you find an article that I wrote collecting all of the research that I could find at that point. But then, so that's like, okay, meditation helps you to reduce stress, reduces the risk of heart disease and certain brain diseases, etc. And there's a huge list. Now, I'm more interested on what meditation does to us as human beings, what it allows us to do, and how it has changed my own life. So the first thing that I noticed as I was going deeper in meditation is that I became less reactive. It's almost like there was this space between stimulus and response. And I realized that this space is the space of my freedom. If there is no space, then you are living automatically. Then you are a product of your environment, right? And there's no freedom there. Whatever is the loudest voice or the loudest stimuli in the environment, you will act in that way. And that may not be aligned with your values and long-term goals. Now, if there's some space that, you know, something happens, someone tells you something that triggers you, and you are aware that a person said that, and you are aware that you know, anger or disgust or whatever the feeling is arising, but you're still kind of like a step back. You can choose to go in a certain direction, or you can choose to ignore and do something else, right? So changing our default from being reactive to being, what's the best word, to having more space, to being calm, that makes a huge difference. The other thing that I noticed is that meditation has helped me be more confident and not being afraid of things. Because as you start going deep inside yourself, you realize by experience that you're able to sit in the midst of any emotional storm. Most people have certain emotions that they do not want to feel, that they would do whatever they can do to avoid feeling those emotions. Maybe it is shame, a fear of failure, fear of rejection, anger, sadness, whatever it is. Now, when you live like this, you're not really free, because if something's important for you, but doing that thing puts you in the risk of experiencing that negative emotion, you won't do it. But if you have that inner freedom and you know that you can sit through and experience any emotion without you losing your center, then you're okay. Then, you know, there is a sense of ease and security that it's hard to come by otherwise. Perhaps the third one that I'm going to mention here that comes to mind is willpower and focus. And this is especially relevant if we're talking about the focus, the concentration styles of meditation, in which you are training your mind to stay in one spot again and again. And that kind of goes against the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is, to use a term used in the Buddhist tradition, to be like a drunken monkey, jumping from branch to branch and not staying anywhere. So when you're trying, by the power of your will, by the power of your determination, to say to the mind, stay here and don't move, you are developing that authority, that self-control, that mastery over the mind. And it doesn't matter if you succeed or not, but just going through that exercise makes you stronger within. It increases your willpower and your ability to focus.
Well, I find that very interesting that you said you're kind of able to be in one place regardless of any emotion that you're going to feel. Like the benefit is that you're sort of stable, because that is, you know, tying into what being stoic is about, is regardless of the external factors that you may be surrounded with, it's about being rooted sort of in this calm mental state that's almost, I guess, zen, if there was a good way to put it, right? You're almost completely unbothered by what's going on around you. The only thing that's concerning you is what's going on in here. So I think that was a great way for you to say that. I guess a follow-up question is, how, you know, if you're looking for a meditation style and you're new or you haven't found one that works for you yet, how can you identify when meditation is working for you? And is it like, is it going to look different for everybody? And you specifically, how did you know when you had found a meditation practice that was working well for you?
Let's go back to the metaphor or the analogy of the sports, right? All sports will be good for your health, for your cardiovascular health and you know, everything. But every sport is different. You know, if 3 times a week you do swimming, you're going to have a different type of development than 3 times a day you go to the gym or you play basketball. They're different types of development. And likewise, all the different styles of meditation, they have some common benefits that are universal to all of them, but they also have some specific benefits and they feel different. They lead to different experiences. So the only way to know what works best for you is to test, to go through different styles in a way that is systematic, not haphazard. Maybe you have a journal where you try a style of meditation and you take note of how you felt and how that go for you. And don't just try it one day, because maybe that day your mind was particularly busy, stressed, distracted. Try it for a few days and then move on to the next one. It's about testing. Now, it's important as you're going through this test that you know what you are after. Maybe you're just exploring the field, and that's okay. You don't know what to expect. But maybe you have a particular goal with meditation practice. If you're going to meditation with a particular goal of improving your focus and willpower, it's going to be a different set of practices that are going to work for you versus if you're going with that goal of, oh, I just want to relax and calm down. Versus if you're going with that goal that I want to have some transcendental spiritual experiences. You know, these different goals, they will lead to different practices. So we can say that it all starts with self-knowledge, and that's something that the ancients have emphasized a lot. Know thyself. If you know thyself, then everything in life gets easier.
One common thread that I see between philosophy or a lot of these meditation practices, just anything that relates to kind of living more fulfilled and living more aware and more mindful, is that it's very introspective. And I think people too often get caught up in things going on around them that are external when they're trying to start meditation journey that kind of dissuade them from doing it. And I think it's important to highlight how introspective it really is. And the fact that it's really 100% self-driven. You mentioned in terms of your vision and what you want to get out of it, but also how it looks for you. And I think to that end, a lot of people our age are, you know, they're starting a family, they're in college, they're starting their career, and they don't have a lot of time to practice meditation. So for people who maybe fall into those groups where they have precious time to spare, what's your advice in terms of if you're in a time crunch, how you can get the most out of meditation and these practices?
If you spend half of the time that you're spending on your phone on the meditation cushion, you'll be enlightened very soon. jokes apart, I think we can all find 10 to 20 minutes to practice daily. And if you do that with the right intention, that already helps. That is already something.
As much as we hate on social media on this podcast, I think that was about as good of an answer as we can get. You know, jokes aside, it's a very straightforward response because we know how much time we're spending on our phones every day. You know, not just with meditation, but with, you know, any new habit you could be trying to build. It could be working out. It could be reading more. It could be anything. We say we don't have time. We don't have, you know, a good routine in place. We're kind of out of flow, right? And it's because we're being distracted by things that are just trying to grab our attention and take us away. And so I guess touching on routine then, you mentioned on, this was on, I believe, your Live and Dare website, but was the importance of a morning routine and how you have a morning routine. So if you're just starting with the morning routine, you know, you seem to have yours down pat. And we know that's through consistency and a lot of practice. And we know that you cannot be perfect every day. You know, I'm sure there's some days where, you know, you might miss a cold shower, you might miss, you know, one aspect. And so with putting emphasis on consistency, how can somebody just starting out, you know, build a productive morning routine to start?
I talk about in the Mindful Self-Discipline book, I talk about five principles of an effective morning routine. And the first one is fixed start, meaning that you decide the time that your routine begins and you start that day every day, no matter what, that you make that part of your day fixed. It's like it's one point of self-discipline that you're not going to move. You treat it as unmovable. And then just having one fixed point in your day, you will see how the other things will start to fall into order. All right. So having a fixed start for your morning routine means you make a decision, you create an alarm clock, and then you don't snooze, no matter what. And the best tip is to keep your phone several feet away from your bed so that it's difficult to snooze, that you cannot snooze unconsciously and go back to sleep. You have to actually get out of bed. And then by that point, you just don't go back. You know, go to the bathroom, start your day, and don't go back. And then for you to have a regular wake-up time, a regular start for your morning routine, you're going to have somewhat of a regular sleep time, because otherwise it's not going to work. And then at this point, if you fix these two, then you're already taking care of your health, because you are fixing your circadian rhythm. The circadian rhythm is the most important biorhythm of the body, and it's controlled mainly by the time we go to sleep, the time we get up, and the time we eat our meals. So you see that you're just starting with the intention of let me have an effective morning routine. And to make that happen, you're going to have to make other tweaks in your life that are going to be good for you in general. Then make it exciting. Make it that the first activity you do in your morning routine is something that you look forward waking up to. You know, maybe there is maybe your favorite book, maybe your favorite cup of coffee or whatever. You know, you only have that if you wake up at 6 a.m. or whatever time you have set for your morning routine. If you snooze, you lose. So you have a reason to wake up on time. So that is the first principle of the morning routine, that you make it a fixed start. Then I talk about having it fixed length. So you decide like, okay, my morning routine is going to be half an hour, or my morning routine is going to be an hour. So that is the time block that you have to play with. You get the activities that you want it to be part of your morning routine. Think about your most important habits in your life. Maybe it is to study Spanish or play the piano or meditate or do a 7-minute workout or, you know, take care of your dog or whatever it is. You put 2 or 3 of those most important daily things in your morning routine. And this makes it sure that you're not going to miss them. And you do them back to back. So if you're going to do 20 minutes of reading and then exercise, you know, after you're done with reading, immediately you go and exercise. Don't leave any gap in between, because that's when we start fantasizing, daydreaming, getting into our phone, and then the morning routine is gone. So that is fixed length. Some people find it helpful to book it on their calendar so that you know your calendar is actually reminding you and that time is there as a reminder for yourself. Then structured, I've already talked about structure, where you keep your most important habits. And it's helpful to go through your morning routine always in the same way every day. So if it's reading, then exercise, then meditation or art or whatever it is, if you do it always in the same way, you're not going to have to think about it. You're not going to have to make decisions. And then you avoid what's known as decision fatigue. Decision fatigue is the fact that every decision we make in our day consumes our cognitive resources, consumes our brain resources. So we want to diminish the number of decisions that we make in our day, especially around trivial topics, so that we have more attention, more energy, and more willpower for the things that matter most. And then focus. Now, this is really important. Stay offline during your morning routine. I suggest to all my coaching clients, go to bed with your phone in airplane mode. Wake up with your phone in airplane mode. There's nothing new. There are no notifications, no red badges, nothing. And you then go through your morning routine offline. And you just go online at the end of your morning routine. At that time, you have already won the morning by doing the things that are most important for you. And finally, the fifth element is achievable. That start with a morning routine that you feel you can do. If you would like to do 30 minutes of exercise, maybe start with 10. If you like to do an hour of meditation, maybe start with 15 minutes so that you're not overstretching your motivation. You're making it easy for you in the beginning until that habit is built. And then you can go deeper, make it longer, etc. So these are the 5 main principles of building an effective morning routine.
Yeah, one thing I notice is in a lot of these the 5 steps, it is you mentioned phones and how they're a very easy distraction. And so I'm very interested, you know, you work with quite a lot of people, so I imagine it's a diverse age range. Have you noticed that people who are maybe our age or younger generations have a harder time getting into these routines and maintaining mindfulness and being able to, you know, maintain a meditation practice because of the fact that, you know, we've grown up with phones and we don't really know an era where we didn't have a phone and we don't have an instant distraction in our hand. So I'm just very interested if you've noticed that it's harder for people, you know, our age to get into these things because of that.
In general, yes. I've noticed that younger people have a harder time with mobile phones and digital distractions. And this is also shown in the fact that most people who come to me are in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Not many come, like really young people. Some of them come to me on their 20s, on their early 20s, and they're like super driven, already kind of high achievers, but super driven to get the most out of their career. Typically, I think young people are not much paying attention to self-discipline, to the need for self-discipline. So yes, it's definitely a bigger challenge.
Well, speaking from experience as someone who is younger, it's definitely, I've talked to my mom about this a lot, and, you know, parents and elders, but they say, you know, we never grew up with phones. You know, I didn't get my first phone until college, or I wasn't exposed to the internet or all of this information until I was in my 20s. And, you know, now you see people and young children getting their first phone. It's changing, literally rewiring their brains into, one, having very short attention spans, and two, just being less attentive in general, right? I mean, we're unable to, we're so in here that we're not focused around what's around us. We're not observing, we're not learning and building those skills up from an early age. And so starting young, because I know that you started meditation relatively young, right? You said it was around 14, 15, that age. So on your this is your Mindful Self-Discipline website, your newer website, you mentioned that meditation helps you feel more in control of your life and your time and your impulses. So before you started meditating, what was your life like emotionally and up here in your mind before you started meditating? And then after you started, what have been, you know, some big changes that are very easy to notice?
Well, the non-reactivity being the main one, that more awareness, less reactivity, more focus, more inner strength. These were the ones that were coming since the beginning, and they were quite obvious for me to know, to notice. And then there are many other benefits that come not directly from meditation practice, but that meditation practice indirectly helps. So, you know, meditation is not going to make you a perfect human being. You're still going to have your triggers, your blind spots, etc. But if you are interested in going through personal growth, personal development, and you are going to use other skills and other techniques, you will notice that the fact that you are trained in meditation will make you much more effective at using those techniques and then, you know, effectively applying them to transform yourself. It's whatever change you want to make in yourself starts with your mind. The mind is the tool, right? The mind is the problem and the solution. Meditation as a powerful way to train our mind gives us that ability to just uplift our capacity to be the person we want to be across the board.
I think there's a degree, at least for me in my journey, and where that self-awareness and kind of that self-understanding breeds confidence, where, you know, like you said, you're aware of, yes, you're less reactive and you have more control over your emotions, but those blind spots and those shortcomings that you mentioned, you're certainly more aware of them through meditation. And, you know, maybe, you know, you haven't fixed them yet, but at least you have that awareness. And I think that breeds confidence a little bit because you know that you can both play to your strengths and acknowledge your weaknesses. With that being said, you just recently released a book titled Wise Confidence. I was hoping you could give our listeners just kind of a brief overview of what Wise Confidence is and what this book's about.
An idea that comes from Aristotle, and it's probably an insight that other people all over the world had as well, is that the virtue is the balanced mean between two extremes. Right? So one extreme is being a coward, and the other extreme is being reckless. And in the middle, we have courage, which is that balance, that virtue. So I like to say that every virtue casts a shadow. You know, every virtue is a strength. It's like our superpower. Some people are really patient, some people are really creative, other people persevere, etc. And all of those things are good. They are like personal, psychological assets. But each of these also casts a shadow. So for example, a person who is very energetic tends to not be very patient. A person who is very patient tends to not be very energetic. Every virtue casts a shadow. And in the path of personal development, we want to become a more holistic human being. And that comes by recognizing that I have these strengths and I have these weaknesses. And these strengths are powerful tools at times, but at other times, they put me in trouble. So I have to develop the opposite strengths to balance them. Now, all of that interest to say that wise confidence is how I see that balanced approach to this virtue. That on one side, you have self-doubt, that you don't do something because you think you will fail. It's that imposter syndrome, that fear of failure. You're beating yourself up. You don't even begin the process. Or if you do, you go through that goal kind of half-heartedly because you don't really believe that it's going to make a difference, that you can make it. You are your worst enemy. On the other end of the spectrum, the other extreme, we have overconfidence or arrogance, in which you think, you know, it's going to be easy. I got it all sorted and piece of cake, you know, no problem. And then that's also a limitation because you are underestimating your challenges. And when you underestimate your challenges, you don't show up with all that you've got because you think you only need to try a little bit for you to win. And that, of course, is delusional. So what we have in the middle is wise confidence. In wise confidence, you are aware of your strengths, but you're also aware of your weaknesses. You're not underestimating yourself, as in self-doubt, but you're also not underestimating the path ahead, as in overconfidence. It's balanced. You're simply showing up with your best self. You're focused on showing up with determination, self-belief, courage, and optimism, giving your best, seeing what happens, getting up and trying again. So that is the concept of wise confidence. You know, one of the key ideas of wise confidence is that the person who you are today is not the limit of who you are. And it's not even the truth of you. It's what I call your conditioned identity. You were born in this world without any idea of who you are, what the world is, and how to navigate this thing called life. And yet, fast forward a few years, we all have really fixed ideas about all of that. And most people, those who are not in a path of personal growth, they will live inside that box for the rest of their lives. And that box is what I call our conditioned identity. And for most people, that box, that conditioning, is not really a happy place. It's not a place that makes them feel confident, worthy, capable, and happy. And the message of the book is that you don't need to live in that box. That is your conditioning. It's not your truth. And your conditioning is a story. It's a story that you have believed in. It's a lie you have told yourself 1,000 times. And now it just feels like the natural truth. Instead, you can conceive of the person you want to be. And I call this designing your aspirational identity. And then start to behave from that new point of view. The person that has the qualities, the virtues, the positive states and emotions that you wish to have, but that are unnatural or so hard for you. You can conceive of a version of yourself that already has all of that naturally. And then to choose to tune in to that mode of being in your day-to-day life, to see the world through those eyes, to think, feel, and act from that perspective. And every time you do this, you're letting go of the old you and you're affirming the new you. You're overcoming your conditioning and affirming your vision. So that is the journey of wise confidence.
It's interesting. I actually had a mentor a while back who said something very similar about you don't need to necessarily be the person that you, you know, think about being. You just have to sort of act like that person. And by doing that, you're tallying points up on the side of the you that you could be. Each day you're faced with a choice, right? You have the side of the board where you could tally a point of your old self or who you are right now, and then the side of the board where you can tally the person that you want to be. And so each day, you know, the more tallies you add to the board, the more you sort of become that person. So I think, you know, your message about wise confidence is that there's an Atomic Habits by James Clear. If you know that book, it's a pretty popular read. I see a similarity between the two, right? It's not about you have to become the person first to start acting like them. It's like, that's how you build a new habit, or that's how you become a new person, is you just do it. Even if you're not where you want to be, the way to do it is to just start. So mm-hmm. I think the terms that you mentioned, your conditioned identity. And then what was the other one? It starts with an A, the
aspirational identity.
Aspirational yeah. identity. Yeah. Those are very, very insightful. And I appreciate those a lot.
Yeah. And I think there's certainly a degree of uncomfortability when it comes to those things. I think most people I agree with are conditioned, whether it's, you know, their parents telling them, you know, like you need to go to college or something like that, especially in the Western world where they get to higher education and they don't know what to do, or, you know, they were conditioned to do this thing and then they get to it and they hate doing it. And it's uncomfortable to say, you know what, I'm going to give up doing this and do something that actually makes me happy. So that degree of uncomfortability, I think, is that something you noticed in your personal life when you were, like you said, you were in law and you were doing IT and then you made a decision to go into teaching? Is that something you experienced? And if so, how did you kind of work through that and get through it?
And it's a lot about awareness, right? For me, I kind of went into the groove of the way of thinking that was inherited by my family. My family, everyone works for the government. No one is an entrepreneur, right? So, my dad's way of thinking is like, no, you go and you get a stable job at the government. They can never fire you. At least that's the case in Brazil where I was born and raised. And you get good money. And then you do whatever you want with your free time. You can do your meditation. You can go to India, like whatever you want. And I kind of bought into that vision. And I lived that for over a decade. And it took me time to realize that, no, that this is not the only way. You know, that's just one way of thinking. As I got exposed to other people that had very different journeys and very different ways of thinking, and I had the openness of mind and the flexibility to question certain assumptions, then, you know, little by little, I became aware that, oh, this is just a conditioning. It may feel scary to go against it, but it's it's actually not. And then start experimenting with that, daring, having the courage, coming back to the four cardinal virtues, having the courage to take a step in that direction. And then you see like, oh, this pays back. This is the right thing to do. So it's a process of awareness, you know, daring to break that conditioning and then to act differently.
You said that it actually wasn't that scary to make the leap. It sort of felt, I can sort of attest, and I'm sure Ren can as well, but when you sort of make the leap into something that you are genuinely interested, it can seem, I think, difficult without knowing what resources to use, but it's like you said, it's not scary. It's sort of an exciting new part of your life that you get to experience, or a certain new trait that you get to acquire, or a certain new habit that you get to build. There's some excitement around it. And again, it all stems from knowing your purpose and what you truly want. And that's what makes it exciting. You know, if you're not truly like passionate about something, it's going to seem uninteresting or scary. But if it's something that you can look dead in the eye and say, you know, I will do everything I can, I will die for this, you know, to even to some extent, then it becomes thrilling, it becomes exciting, it becomes purposeful.
It can feel scary before you do the leap, but once you are doing the leap, or once you have done it, then it's like, oh, this was it. Like, I remember I was going about it the very kind of responsible way, you know, that my dad is very responsible with money, and he has always put values in us to value security and to not kind of take risks, etc. And it took me a lot of time for me to make that shift from being a 9-to-5 employee to being an entrepreneur and a freelancer in a way. And because I wanted to get to a certain number in my savings. So I thought like, okay, I have won the right to quit my job and to give it a go. And if it doesn't work, I can go back. And I did that, and it felt safe and responsible. And I remember at that time where I was wondering like, oh, should I do this or not? I'm earning quite well in my job. In one of the entrepreneurial podcasts I was listening, the guy said like, oh, I realized that I was a software developer. So if the startup thing didn't work out, I could just cross the street, waving my resume, and I'll get a job. And I felt like, oh, I'm also a software developer. Like, why am I resisting taking this leap? And I knew that there was a lot of demand for app developers in Sydney, where I was living. So I took that leap, and fast forward several years, I look back now, and the only thing I regret is that I was playing too safe, that I could have taken that leap a year before, you know? And that year before, like, yes, I would have had less savings, but I would have progressed my career more quickly. And at the end of the day, I would have earned more, and I would have entered into my actually dream career a year earlier than the way it happened.
Yeah, one of the most common things that I see in philosophy is living a life of purpose and fulfillment versus a life of possessions and kind of that security that you mentioned. And it's certainly a difficult concept to kind of wrap your head around. Many people aren't going to say, you know, I'm going to take the risk that maybe I'm not financially secure just so I can live my dream. It's very hard for people to kind of get to that place. But it's very funny you mentioned, you know, listening to podcasts and that being the inspiration, is that if you listen to anybody talk about this in terms of, I abandoned this 9-to-5 job for my dreams, they regret that they didn't do it sooner. Very rarely do you hear, oh, you know, I really wish I would have stayed in this 9-to-5. And it's something that you don't really kind of hear. And I think it's something where, you know, evaluating those resources and hearing the people talk about it is very important. And it's one of the reasons we like having our podcast, having our platform, talking about Stoicism and philosophy, is having and utilizing those resources make it kind of 10 times easier to take that leap. Having, you know, the support of, you know, oh, I can see visually that this person made it. This person had success. This person's here to help me, and there are these resources. And so it's great, you know, one of the perks of living in an age of a lot of distractions and the digital age is through all those distractions, there are resources like those apps you mentioned, or, you know, the courses you teach, or whatever have you in the area of your interest that are available to you. And I think it's something that people too often don't realize is that, yes, you know, like we've kind of talked about circling back, that these distractions can certainly hurt you and take you away from your purpose and kind of lead you adrift. But they also, if utilized correctly, can help you in a large way. And I think it's something that's very important to highlight. And it's something that I'm very grateful that we got to have you on the podcast today, because it's one example of a resource that you can utilize. This is a very important resource when it comes to meditation.
Absolutely. And I would like to add to your point, Giovanni, the one thing you said that stood out to me was how experience and seeing visible results are sort of the best way to sort of spread this message and about mindfulness. And the exact same thing goes for Stoicism as well. Marcus Aurelius says, spend no time arguing what a good man should be one. And that is the exact same thing, right? It's not about promoting something. It's not about, you know, being the face of something simply for, you know, publicity. It's about actually having the results and have spent, you know, the hours and the time that's very, very difficult mastering your mind to go through these things. So there's a lot of things you said that parallel directly to what we talk about on this podcast. And that's exactly why, you know, this was such an amazing, I guess, dynamic that we all could share, is we could just sort of bring the parallels of meditation and mindfulness, which we did our own episode on very early on in this podcast. It probably wasn't our best work, but we did an episode on mindfulness to begin with. And now to have someone who's, you know, an understatement, is an expert on this topic. You said you almost became a monk twice, correct?
Yes.
And someone who has, you know, gone to such measures to, you know, find the depths of this topic and bring them to the light and share them with people. It's kind of an amazing thing that we can now see the parallels and talk about them on this platform and bring them to the light to share with other people.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. And one thing I was curious about is, in that journey of almost becoming a monk twice, are there any like cool personal stories you have, or very amazing people that you met during that journey? I'd imagine they're going to those places. There's probably some very cool, I guess, for lack of a better term, cool people that you get to meet.
Nothing particular is coming up now, but you know, in a way, these meditation masters, they are like the Olympic athletes of the mind. You know, they have achieved a really high level in their skill, in their path, and the way that they speak carries a certain energy about it. It's not just the words; it's that just being in their presence, you already feel more calm. You feel like they understand something that you don't understand, and sometimes they give you answers that make no sense, and in your mind you start arguing with it. But if you're humble and you stay, and after some time, maybe it's going to be 3 days, 3 weeks, or 3 years, after some time it's like, ah, now I understand, like he was right, I couldn't see it. So no particular stories come to mind now, but just this sense of awe and reverence that I have for what they have achieved in their path. You know, most people would struggle to keep their mind focused on their breath for 5 seconds. And some of these people can keep it for 5 hours without having a single thought. You know, and I met people like this. And it's just unbelievable and inspiring.
It's amazing to hear you speak on that kind of presence and the aura that they generate around them. I think that's something that many people stand to benefit from, and it's great that you were able to turn that into what you're doing now in terms of being such an important meditation coach and servicing so many people. And I think there's something to be said about having those types of role models and those experiences to kind of guide you in your journey. But it just highlights the importance of role models in any journey you're on when it comes to purpose, whether, you right. know, it's your family members or people close to you who maybe are employing some of these tactics, or, you know, if you go out for those external sources. I think role models play a very important factor when it comes to anything that's introspective. And, you know, I'd like to hear your opinion on the presence of role models within your personal journey and how important that is for people who maybe want to pick up these practices or just improve their lives.
Yes. There is a quote from the Persian poet Rumi: set your life on fire, seek those who fan your flames. And for me, that is the role of a role model. It's someone that shows you what's possible. And as a kid or growing up, when you see someone doing something that is like amazing or awe-inspiring, then maybe that lights a spark in you. And why does it light a spark in you and not on your friend or brother? Like, we don't know. Maybe if I've watched someone do skateboarding extremely skillfully, that doesn't spark anything on me. But if I watch someone singing or doing martial arts, then that sparks something. We don't know. That's probably connected to our deeper sense of purpose. But that is the blessing of being in the presence of someone who has achieved a high level of mastery in whatever they are doing. That sparks a fire inside of us. And then if we have the right mindset towards that fire, if we don't get distracted away from that fire, and nowadays it's so easy to get distracted away, if we kind of stay with it and then organize our lives around that, around cultivating that, then one day we can become like them.
You mentioned courage a lot, and I know, you know, one thing, it was an example, right? Because it was sort of the middle ground between being reckless and being a coward. And that's interesting. And then you go into actually talk about, you know, how courage and wise confidence are related. Courage is one of the four cardinal Stoic pillars. And the four Stoic pillars are courage, temperance, wisdom, and justice. And I think those are all, you know, the middle ground between virtue and vice, or like you said, every virtue casts a shadow, which is an incredible analogy because it's something that we might not think about. You know, we say, oh, I'm very, you know, I'm always trying to be smarter and smarter and smarter, but then you get to be too, where you think you're so smart and you're arrogant, right? And then it's sort of that shadow that the virtue is casting. That's brilliant. So then do you see a direct or indirect relationship between philosophy and mindfulness? And if you do, how has philosophy itself and that connection influenced your, you know, your courses, your books, your teachings, etc.?
In the traditional way that mindfulness came about in the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness is not something for you to feel calm and enjoy the moment. That was not the purpose at all. Mindfulness was a tool as part of a bigger system that the Buddha has conceived. And that bigger system has, you can say philosophy, has a particular way of looking at things, of understanding the world and understanding ourselves. And all of the tools in that system, including mindfulness, they are there to perform a role. They are there to help you achieve the goal that that system was created to achieve. So In the wisdom traditions of the East, which is what I am most familiar with, of course, I've studied a little bit of the classics. I read Plato, Aristotle, some of the Stoics, etc. But I'm more familiar with the traditions of the East. And in there, the practice and the philosophy, they're always intertwined. Because you believe in certain philosophy, you look through those lenses, you do certain practices.
If you had to specify, how did those teachings specifically influence how you decided to build your courses and write your books and then, you know, teach what mindfulness is, what specific aspects or components of those, you know, Eastern philosophies have become very prevalent in your works?
And the challenge here is that I read and studied these particular teachings since I'm 15, 16. And so it has become so much merged with my way of thinking from many sources at the same time that at times it's difficult to pick apart. But I think the first obvious answer is this idea about virtues, you know, the approach of the Stoics around virtue, Aristotle's idea of it being the balanced middle. That's something that is key in my work. And I don't hear many people talk about this these days, and I find it very important. The idea from the Stoics that you get to determine what events mean to you, that, you know, life, fortune is going to go its way and life and things are going to happen in your life, but you get to decide how you react to those events and what those events mean to you. So that's something that, you know, goes back to the Stoics, but it's very present in many authors of personal development in the 20th century. These are a couple of ideas that I can immediately identify came from that.
Yeah, we mention quite frequently how kind of unpopular, or I guess just unaware, people are of a lot of these Stoic concepts. And I think that same kind of sect of people, especially in our generation, are also unaware of a lot of these Buddhist teachings and a lot of these using mindfulness as a tool. I know one of your goals, you stated, is getting many, many more people, a million people, I believe, to practice meditation and teach them meditation. So how can people go out and kind of spread this message and raise awareness really on how important these things are, especially to our generation?
I think first, the person needs to experience within themselves, right? When you do the practice and you experience the shift, then you know, then you're speaking from experience. You're not just promoting something in the hope that it will take you to heaven. Like you know, like this makes my life better here and now. And I am excited to share this news with other people. So that's the main thing. And there are many different ways to get started in meditation. You know, traditionally, you would go to a meditation teacher. You would learn from that teacher, whatever techniques they teach. And you'll be corrected and improved your skill in meditation little by little. Nowadays, most people will learn meditation from apps. It's the easiest way to start, but often, in the case of most apps, it lacks depth. So I would say, like, if you're interested in meditation and you tried some from the apps out there, go get a couple of good books to really understand, to study more, to know what you're doing. And then that will help you even know how to select a practice more easily.
And when it comes to books, do you have any books of specific authors that you found to be better than others? You know, there's a lot of, I think when it comes to nonfiction, especially, right, and, you know, self-help, there's definitely a wide range of authors and, you know, styles of writing. Are there certain books that you picked up or would recommend that helped you start your journey or like starting to gain experience?
You know, for me, my journey, I was reading a lot about Zen Buddhism and Taoism when I was in my teenage years. So that's how I started in particular. How I would recommend people to start, it depends on a lot of things. It wouldn't be the same way for everybody. For me, you know, like a very influential book when I was growing up, both as a man and in my practice, was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki, and also The Compass of Zen. So those were two books in the Zen tradition that I found very helpful.
Yeah, certainly unpopular advice to people our age is pick up a book. Many people aren't really used to reading a paperback book anymore, but I think there's certainly a value to actually, you know, actually physically picking up a book, especially when it relates to something so introspective and important as meditation and understanding yourself and understanding your emotions.
Yes.
That there's certainly a lack of value, you know, certainly like you said, with these apps, they're there and they're a good tool, but there's kind of something missing when it comes to these apps, because like you said, those lack of depth that I think books do a great job of providing. Books were certainly influential to Matteo and I's journey with Stoicism, and it's awesome to hear that they were important to you as well when it comes to your journey.
So you mentioned purpose, how you sort of have to establish your sense of purpose, right, before you can really identify what's important to you. And you were talking about that with what meditative practices work. You sort of have to identify what your goal is and like what you want your purpose to be, what you want your specific outcome to be with it. And so I guess your purpose in meditation, what's kept you here for so long? I mean, what's really deep down that's keeping you going? You know, you've had the experiences, you could have taken many paths, you could have chosen to stop and start something new, but why are you still here preaching this and practicing after, you know, many years of experience?
You know, in the beginning, I wasn't teaching. It was just my own journey. I was doing my meditation practice and I was doing other jobs. You know, first, I graduated in law and I was working with law, with the government. Then I shifted to IT, taught myself programming, and I was doing iPhone app development in different companies. So at that those points, until I was about 30 years old, meditation was not something that I was teaching. I had taught in Zen retreats in the past, but I wasn't actively teaching. I decided to start teaching it because first I saw that, to my surprise, meditation had become really popular. Like when I was meditating and everyone was asking me about it in my teenage years, it was awkward. And then I kind of got disconnected from all of that and just kept doing my own journey. And then come back and like, oh, it's actually popular now. People are meditating for different reasons. So I felt like, okay, I can use this experience to the service of people who want to learn and explore meditation. So that's why I began sharing. I felt it was more strongly connected to my purpose than doing the work that I was doing in my career before. So that answers part of the question. Now, the other part of the question, why do I myself continue exploring and deepening, is because in a way, I have tasted something that is beyond what this life can offer. The states of consciousness that you can get into in deep meditation, the inner peace, the bliss, the sense of connection, it's hard to put it in words. I don't find that in any other experience in life. And I live a very good life from all angles. But what is possible through meditation practice, what we can touch through that inner journey, is not available anywhere else. And continuing to explore that is part of my life purpose.
And even still, after all these years, I mean, you still have things you can learn and pick up. I think that's sort of the beauty of self-mastery, is you'll never actually get there. You know, you'll never actually fully master yourself or fully master your mind or anything. But you can become so, you know, experienced and so good at it that it almost seems to people who aren't that you have. I think that's sort of the beauty of, you know, becoming the trick of the trade, right? Is that there really isn't a trick. It's just experience and it's hard work and it takes a lot of time.
So one question that we like to ask all the guests is, if you had one piece of advice for people our age and younger generations to just live a fulfilling life, what would that piece of advice be?
As much as possible to remove yourself from distraction and to get in touch with your core, with your sense of purpose. Meaning that once you figure out the person that you want to be, once you figure out your aspirations in life, then you know, you can organize your whole life around that. And you'll be living a fulfilling life. You'll be living life in a way that is more engaged, in a way that is more meaningful. There are many studies showing that people who have a strong sense of purpose, they live longer, they have a stronger immune systems, they are less likely to fall into depression and anxiety, etc. There's a really good book on this topic, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Probably many of your listeners will be familiar with that work. So his book is one of the main books to inspire us to get in touch with a sense of purpose. That a life that is driven by purpose, by what I call aspirations in my book, is very different from a life that is devoid of that central organizing principle. And I mentioned also distractions as part of my answer, because distractions is a problem both before and after figuring out your aspirations. You know, before is, if you are so distracted with instant gratification, then you don't have the mind space, you don't have the inner space or the patience to look within and to figure out what matters most. Because, you know, looking within and figuring out your purpose, that's some deep soul searching work. And you're not guaranteed to find some satisfaction there quickly. But if you open your phone and tap your favorite app, you are guaranteed to find some sense of satisfaction. It's going to be superficial, but it's there, right? So that is the problem with distractions. We have the need to feel good, the need to pursue something that feels good. You know, Socrates has said that every man is searching for his own good. The only difference is how different people define that good, right? So if you are training yourself to experience that feel good through instant gratification that is effortless, then you're training your brain to have zero motivation to pursue things that are deeper, because they take time and they take effort. So that is the main problem with distractions. It's not so much the amount of time you spent doing them. If you spend 2 hours in distracting apps and information every day, but that had no effect, that didn't affect your brain, it would still be okay. You lost 2 hours, like a part-time job, but you would still be okay. But the problem is that the time we're spending in distractions and instant gratification, that is changing our brain. That is changing our capacity. That is harming our capacity to be focused, to be motivated, to be creative in our lives. And so that is the main challenge with distractions. And so I have to mention You know, the subtitle of my book is How to Live with Purpose and Achieve Your Goals in a World of Distractions. These two things, we need to deal with them at the same time.
And the motto of our podcast as well is we are guiding people with Stoic philosophy in the digital age, or if you want an exact synonym, in the distraction age, right? And there's a perfect quote that goes along with what you said from Seneca, where he says, you act like mortals in all that you fear and like immortals in all that you desire. You spend all this time with the distractions, doing the things that are purposeless, and we're complacent. You know, we say, yeah, we have all this time. It's not going to affect me. And we act that we're completely unbothered, but we know that that's untrue. And I want to hear Ren's opinion as well on this book by Frankl, because as soon as you mentioned Viktor Frankl, his eyes lit up. And we were saying before we started this podcast that you and Viktor Frankl actually have a very similar ideology in the way you think, the way you speak. And so I know Ren's been, you know, eager to say this, so I will let him have his comment on this.
Yeah, no, I encourage any of our listeners who like Viktor Frankl to check out any of the articles written by Giovanni, because they mirror very closely to a lot of teachings by Viktor Frankl. And a lot of the themes like master your mind, master yourself, are certainly things present in Viktor Frankl. And so I'm just happy to hear you mention him, because there's a lot of similarities I was seeing between your guys' work. So I was curious if you've read Man's Search for Meaning and any other Viktor Frankl's works.
Yes, I read Man's Search for Meaning. That book is a little bit hard to digest in the beginning, because it's like some really heavy experiences in the concentration camp. But then maybe the last third of the book is where he talks about all his life philosophy that made it possible for him to survive the concentration camp. And don't just skip to that part, because you will not understand it fully unless you have gone through the whole story. And then it's everything connects very powerfully.
Yeah, that context for me is why it's one of my favorite works, is just the weight and gravity of his situation really lends, I think, a lot of credibility to his philosophy. Not a lot of us would be able to survive what he went through in the healthy manner that he did, and, you know, turning his life into something where he created a lot of change and a lot of positive impact in the world, despite going through dark times. So I agree with that advice. I think the beginning is very hard to get through. It's a difficult read. It's certainly very dark, very heavy, but that weight and that gravity makes the ending so much better and makes his advice, I think, so much more credible and so much more impactful. And so that's why I enjoyed reading a lot of the articles on your website, is they reminded me of those teachings in the philosophy in which Frankl embodies. And I think, you know, if we can see that, we can see that Stoicism, you know, maybe he wasn't purely Stoic, but Stoicism very closely relates to a lot of these mindfulness techniques you're talking about, and the habits you're talking about, and the self-discipline aspect, which has been a consistent theme throughout this episode. And so I think for people maybe who aren't, you know, closely tied into one school of philosophy or aren't big into philosophy, I think they can see that all these schools teach you how to better live your life, and all of them employ some sort of mindfulness. So I think that's something that can be said about the importance of mindfulness and maybe practicing a little bit of meditation in terms of improving your life and improving the way you feel fulfilled and purpose-driven.
I just want to say, I think seeing someone speak from experience about having put in so much time, you know, into one area and to learning so much and putting, you know, gaining experience is inspiring and should be a major takeaway from this episode, is that great things take a lot of time, and they take a lot of failures, and they take a lot of, you know, times where giving up seems like the best option. But like you said, the only regret that you might have is that you didn't start the journey sooner, you know, that you didn't get started quicker. So the pain of failure is nowhere near what the pain of regret will ever be. And so I think with that, I just want to say, you know, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your experiences and your insights with us. It's not only a privilege to us, but to our audience and your audience as well. I think that what you're doing should have a bigger audience for you. I mean, you already have a great audience, but I think it should be bigger. I think more people should be aware of what you're doing. And so the collaboration and the, you know, connection of our specialty, Stoicism, and your specialty being mindfulness and meditation and other forms of Eastern philosophies is exactly what, you know, the world needs to hear.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed the conversation.